Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. It's Trent Kling and Leighton Kling with you this week. Earnings season hits with full force, and it's a season for some retail transformations more than just earnings. Office Depot and Vitamin Shoppe in particular. We'll talk about both of those, as well as the big double news in the mattress industry with Casper potentially entering more brick and mortar spaces and Mattress Firm going in the opposite direction potentially. If you haven't already, please take just a quick second to rate us however you listen, whether that be on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, wherever, Spotify, and the list goes on. We always love the feedback from people. And additionally, exciting news, we're brought to you this week by MyEmma.com. MyEmma.com can help with all of your email marketing needs, and we'll talk about them a little bit later on in the show. Check us out also on Instagram and Twitter at Retail Podcast. So now that we've gotten some of the introductions out of the way, let's launch into this transformational quarter for Office Depot as they reported earnings for their second quarter on Tuesday. The stock popped up more than 10% during trading hours, up 14% at one point. And we felt like it was important for us to lead with this story to shed light on what this means compared to the stock performance over the last year. Now, granted, it's not always about stocks with retailers, and sometimes stocks are a very bad indicator of how well a retailer is doing. But shares were up over $2.80 on Tuesday. This April, just this last April, shares hit five-year lows near the $2 range. And this time last year, shares were at $6. So for those investors that have stayed put, it has been a rocky ride and mostly a negative one. But some of that negativity may be over, not in six-month numbers, but rather those last three-month numbers.
What a transformational story indeed for Office Depot, as a lot of you who may be working or living around an Office Depot have seen an in-store transformation, as you see a lot of refurbishing and a lot new training of associates, sort of a new strategy for them. And we'll talk a little bit about the other things they are going into. But for the fiscal year to date, as Trent had alluded to, net income from continuing operations was down to $52 million or 9 cents per share, compared to net income from continuing operations of $95 million or 18 cents per share in the first half of 2017. That sounds bad. However, shares this week jumped presumably for a number of reasons, as the embattled retailer showed not only positive adjusted earnings this latest quarter, but an analyst beat by 25%. So adjusted earnings per share hit 5 cents during the second quarter versus the expectation from analysts of 4 cents per share. Revenue for us was the biggest figure to keep an eye on during this release, as they pulled out in that number as well. Top line revenue was $2.63 billion, which beat consensus expectations by about $50 million in total. It wasn't just about beating Wall Street marks, but how they fared compared to last year. A lot of companies will end up beating on top line revenue marks, but you'll see a deceleration of revenue. That is the exact opposite for Office Depot here. Many companies are able to beat those revenue expectations, but still having that falling number leading you to kind of scratch your head when the stock price goes up. But for Office Depot, this actually marked an acceleration, wherein second quarter revenue was 11% greater than last year. So no one anymore can say that Office Depot is dying, at least anytime soon. CEO Jerry Smith made it a point repeatedly throughout the earnings call, and I read the transcript to confirm. He mentioned double-digit increases, that particular accomplishment, several times, something he was very proud of, and he felt like this is going to be a continuation of good things to come. The kicker is that physical stores did lack in solid comps, wherein same-store sales hit negative 2%. We contend that is definitely a bad number, but it could have been worse. The reason for the increase in the overall business revenue is not just because people have decided to buy more of the same products over and over again, but rather they have a more diversified product base and service portfolio such that they have more to offer their current and existing customer base. That customer base is now 29 million strong, according to its leadership.
Couple of different things they've been doing. They've been making acquisitions and extending their business-to-business side so a greater percentage of revenue comes in from those segments. We've talked in quarters past about just how important growing those segments will be for Office Depot. They can no longer rely on some of the retail sales or to the public sales. Note the inclusion as well of CompuCom, that IT services and network infrastructure company Office Depot bought last year for $1 billion in the finances. This year, CompuCom has a large network of Fortune 1000 companies that they had long-term relations with, which was arguably a huge buying point for Office Depot. Now, during the conference call, they did cite their goal of having deeper, more sustainable customer relationships through all that they are doing with their CompuCom acquisition and overarching strategy. Of course, service and convenience, they feel like it's still something that they can compete on, especially if they focus on managing their larger current customer base as well, so they don't jump ship to another service, say many of Amazon's services designed for corporations. The idea here for Office Depot, they want to keep all current customers inside the system by creating, well, a system, a service ecosystem is what they call it. Companies they hope will feel obligated to stay with Office Depot because of the ease of use of the system and because they're comfortable. There's not a massive transition when jumping ship from Office Depot to another service provider. Now, Gary Smith, Office Depot's CEO, said that sales in their business solutions division were actually up. They were up 4%. He called this number impressive. He mentioned that this was driven largely by their acquisition strategy. We mentioned, of course, CompuCom, but also what they referenced is adjacency categories beyond just office products. Services have increased their piece of the pie in terms of the revenue that they're bringing in, up to 16% of total sales at Office Depot now. To take a step back and give a larger view of how their strategy has fundamentally changed the business from a year ago, when you look at 1 year ago in the second quarter, product revenues were only up 1% versus a 120% jump over a year ago in service-related revenues. Again, a lot of that has to do with the acquisition, but has to do with a changing business structure at Office Depot. They had $48 million in operating cash this quarter versus $41 million last quarter. Also a positive sign. Adjusting for one-time expenditures, they did match last year's operating income when you make those adjustments of just over $62 million.
Cash management was key for the company, and it definitely showed this quarter. They had $177 million in free cash flow. Year to date, this time last year, they only had $60 million in free cash. Operationally, despite their best efforts to rein in costs, gross margins did suffer as the cost of goods ended up going up just a little bit, and selling, general, and administrative expenses were also up. And also, if you dig deep in the comments section on their formal earnings release, you see that generalized, what they call corporate costs, were up $132 million thanks to staff services and different compensation packages. Investor relations notes alluded to these increases being tied to growth initiative, so perhaps they are giving executives or senior management tied into this transformative strategy a little bit of a bump to really incentivize the growth going forward and to remain strong for the remainder of 2018. They also haven't forgotten much about their investors either, as they bought back around $8 million in shares and announced a dividend of around 2.5 cents per share, 10 cents a share on an annualized basis, of course, on the common stock for the company. The dividend, if you're a shareholder, is payable on September 14th of this year. Shareholders of record by the close of business August 24th will be eligible. Shares, like we said at the beginning, were up on Tuesday, but also up on Wednesday, fairly significantly in the single digit range, giving a company a boost to land the shares around $3. Really, like Trent had said at the beginning of the story, this is a company you have to keep an eye on, but shares have been extremely volatile. It's really going to be up to management over the next year to keep this momentum in place and to see if this strategy works out. CVS reported on Wednesday of this week, and it was yet another positive news story for this pharmacy retailer in that following the earnings release, CVS shares, ticker CVS, rose 4.5%. This is a retailer we've kept a close eye on due to the Aetna merger that is nearing an answer from certain regulators. Multiple regulators, in fact, have their hand in that decision, and we'll focus on that a little bit later through the management comments that were given after the earnings release. But another reason for CVS's relevance is Walgreens taking on the 1,932 stores and rebranding most of those stores this year from Rite Aid. By count, Walgreens has now over 9,800 stores. CVS, by the way, has almost an identical number. We couldn't exactly get a perfect figure. Their website says over 9,800 stores, so we assume very close to the count of Walgreens. We note that Walgreens had a few to lose in their Walgreens branded stores before they got final approval on their final revised offer for the Rite Aid stores and got that pushed through regulators, but the remainder of which Albertsons, of course, wants to buy. So a lot happening in the pharmacy retail space. Lastly, over the last month, Amazon announced it was buying PillPack, an online pharmacy, for around $1 billion, according to some insiders, because the formal price actually wasn't given by Amazon. It was a private deal. Shares of all the major pharmacies after the PillPack deal closed took a dive on the news. Obviously, we have that all-important Amazon effect that we talk about ad nauseum on this podcast.
And we should mention, past tense in terms of Albertsons wanting to buy Rite Aid now, as Rite Aid backed away from the table just as we started recording this podcast. So it looks like that deal will not go through. As a Rite Aid shareholder, not sure what to think about that. Also, full disclosure, I am a CVS shareholder. I bought in right after that Amazon effect that Leighton was talking about took place. And I was very pleased with this quarter that we expected was going to be this robust for CVS, as they showed continued progress in a number of areas. As always, the main decider in the fate of the quarter was prescription drug sales, again making up an increasing amount of the revenue pie. Now, over 71% of revenue at CVS comes from their pharmacy services division. Now, speaking of that revenue, it was up a whole $1 billion, $1 billion over last year's second quarter, or 2.2% increase to $46.7 billion. That's a Wall Street beat by over $350 million. Wall Street may be a little bit bearish, or should we say more bearish than they should have been, regarding CVS. Pharmacy network claims rose 5.9%, and total same-store prescription volume was up 9.5%. In-store, this meant 8.3% more pharmacy-related revenue. These numbers, again, just astounding, but CVS has laid the groundwork for this over the last couple of years, and it's something I feel like more analysts should have expected. Both Walgreens and CVS have focused less on front-of-the-store retail, and probably for good reason, but CVS, as we mentioned in their last quarter, they've done the better of the two. CVS, for this latest quarter, saw front-end same-store sales decline 1%. This is actually after seeing positive numbers in their last quarter, but a decline of 1%, you'll take it as long as that pharmacy-related revenue in-store is increasing 8.3% to more than offset that 1% decline in front-end same-store sales. Now, in terms of earnings, GAAP numbers didn't look as great as all of that I just talked about would indicate. There's a loss of $2.52 per share attributable to an impairment charge of $3.9 billion for its long-term care business. Luckily, analysts are always more interested in adjusted figures. Adjusted figures completely flipped that around, came in 8 cents higher than expectations at $1.69 per share. As long as you put away that impairment cost, things looking plenty rosy for CVS. The company also raised the bottom end of their expected full-year earnings per share range, which is another thing analysts and Wall Street both like to see. CVS ended the quarter with $4.4 billion in free cash flow, thanks to an infusion of $3.9 million in long-term debt, for which now they have nearly 3 times as much as last year. Their CEO, Larry Merlo, said in a statement during the earnings call that basically everything that they saw, all these positive numbers, he mentioned they were a direct result of their team's ability to increase prescription growth by not only expanding relationships with pharmacy benefit managers outside of those that CVS owns, but also streamlining efforts and innovation within the company.
With innovation and growth being some of the key words there in the statement that Trent just read, the bigger idea may be to keep track of the increasing expectation of convenience, that customers enjoy pretty much everything being brought to their home that is not already a prescription drug. So for instance, on Amazon, everyone keeps buying supplements, as we'll talk about a little bit later with the vitamin shop. Everyone keeps buying household electronic items. knickknacks, you get the point. But prescription drugs, not a massive business online. And so the key here, again, these key remarks, innovation and growth, that is going to be a main driver here. Who can get to that business first and who is going to be the winner and who are going to be the losers? And I bet you that some of the losers are going to be some legacy retailers that just did not funnel enough capital. And I think CVS sees this and they are doing the right thing. They're taking out long-term debt and they're really placing an interest in prescription drug delivery. Last week, CVS announced that they were expanding same-day and two-day deliveries in a number of larger markets. In 2017, they introduced a similar service for New York City, so they've already had sort of a trial and error run in New York City, but they're expanding it now to Boston, Miami, Philadelphia, San Francisco, and the DC metro area. And this is interesting, Trent, because this actually came out last week, about a week and a day ago, before the earnings release came out. So this was already kind of in place. The plans were already in place. I think it probably would have been better for the company, even better for the stock price, even though we saw a spike in the stock, to have announced these plans now, because a lot of analysts are going to be asking these kind of questions, talking about delivery to customers' homes. The idea here being that many medications are ordered on a regular basis. So a lot of opportunity here for pharmacy benefit managers and retail pharmacies, where patients are given a regimen for non-acute conditions wherein they have to refill every month or every 2 months. The argument against, if you can make one, the argument against delivering pharmaceuticals has long been that customers need some medications immediately, and waiting two or more days is not advisable at all. That's why a lot of doctors issue a script and make sure that you have it picked up. And that's why Walgreens and CVS have mobile applications to give you proper notifications so you can get to the pharmacy as soon as that particular prescription is filled. This is most likely why CVS has been taking its time, building out a network first in New York City, testing what works, testing what doesn't. And now they've built a network in which they feel as though they can quickly serve at least urban customers in a more hastened manner. Orders can be placed over the phone, of course, or on their app, which I just mentioned, which has seen multiple upgrades as CVS's pharmacy benefit network has grown immensely over the past several quarters. Some analysts believe that there will always be at least a market for some over-the-counter presence within brick-and-mortar stores. So this is also a good thing. If you're thinking that CVS brick-and-mortar is going by the wayside anytime soon, I believe you are wrong, and I believe academics and analysts are correct when they say that there is a need for over-the-counter medicine, and that a lot of people aren't going to be buying that stuff online and wait 2 days, because people still go in and look at medicines that are for, let's say, conditions such as heartburn or reducing bad cold symptoms. They need immediate relief. We're talking about a 2 to 3 hour window, not a 2 to 3 day window.
Oftentimes, we're not necessarily talking about the urban markets throughout the country. We're talking about a lot of suburban markets, small towns. People oftentimes forget about assisted living facilities and the need for a quick turnaround there. And a service like Amazon, at least for now, isn't able to fill that void that CVS and Walgreens do so well, in particular CVS. Real quick, though, we wanted to update everyone on the Aetna deal that is going on behind the scenes. At CVS, management said that everything's been going pretty well, that their legal teams are ironing out details with state regulators and the Department of Justice. They reminded analysts on the call that some states hold off approval until the Department of Justice formally weighs in. It is a lengthy process, of course, filled with red tape, but in this case, a lot of states waiting until the big guns go ahead and give their opinion on things. Their CEO doesn't think divestment of any current business operation would need taken place to get the merger done, as what Leighton referenced with Walgreens and Rite Aid earlier. He expects the Aetna acquisition complete by the end of quarter three or quarter four. So you're looking at potentially as soon as 2 months from now, maybe as long as 5 months from now. As far as when the deal gets done, we're assuming it does. They do have integration teams already in place. They're getting out in front of that, and they have a goal in place already to give around $750 million in synergy savings by the end of the second year. They're doing pressure tests equivalent to kind of a large bank's stress tests that you often hear about to see if they're able to evaluate every opportunity to create value. Larry Merlo, and we found this interesting on the call, he took the time to thank the current employees that, due to these synergies, will eventually be laid off. That's an interesting approach, but also kind of a weird thing to say when you're seeking government approval over a merger. We know oftentimes with a merger like this or a buyout, layoffs are inevitable. Now, shares of the company went up another 1% or so on Tuesday to over $69 at various points in the day. Looking at the simple one-year chart, CVS, it's been a roller coaster ride for them as well. Highs over $82 a share, lows near 60, particularly after that Amazon news. Volatility due to weakness in their Omnicare business and the continued investment in licensing activities from Amazon, as they're now a licensed online pharmacy. Amazon is in a number of states, and now they're licensed for medical equipment sales in nearly all states. Still, CVS, a market cap of $70 billion, whereas Walgreens Boots Alliance has a $63 billion market cap. We've talked about it on the show before, but I think we're more bullish on CVS than we are on Walgreens. And CVS is beating Walgreens to the punch in just about every area of their retail operations, and no reason to believe that wouldn't continue going forward. Now, to our listeners out there, I'm going to give you some advice for anyone that sends emails to their customers. Look, you deserve a better email marketing platform, one that's actually designed with your type of organization in mind. Go above and beyond cookie cutter. And unlike other email providers, Emma puts its customers first, offering powerful email marketing with a personal touch.
With Emma, you'll have everything you need to connect your data, build your audience, and do your most successful marketing ever. Because their easy-to-use platform makes advanced functionality accessible to everyone on your team with no technical skills required, you can even connect Emma with the services you currently count on to run your business, like Salesforce and Google Analytics. Not to mention, Emma's award-winning team is always ready to support you on your email marketing strategy, design, list migration, and more.
So put the power of email experts behind your marketing. Request a customized demo of Emma's email marketing platform today at myemma.com. Again, that's myemma, EMMA.com. We launch into the second half of the show with the mattress retail space. It gets a bit of a shakeup, or a proposed shakeup, as Casper seems to be leaning towards opening 200 more brick-and-mortar locations, and Mattress Firm may be going the other way and shrinking the number of brick-and-mortar locations on top of the locations they've already closed to begin the year. We begin with the former. We always want to talk good news first, as we discuss Casper on a Looking Ahead segment last year. As they turn to having pop-up shops to spread brand awareness, we can assume their pop-up shop concept was a success, as the predominantly online-only retailer is looking to add a robust store presence in a number of U.S. markets.
They start off with one location, and we actually talked about that on the podcast, and it was interesting for us because this was going to be a temporary pop-up shop to Trent's point, really spread brand awareness. But we see that Casper has slowly progressed into 19 current pop-up shop locations throughout North America, San Francisco and New York City being the two larger markets they currently have a presence in. They reportedly average $1,500 per square foot at these locations. So pretty good, considering those market rents are probably going to be fairly high in Class A spaces, which, of course, is what they are targeting. The plan for the near term is to have 200 stores in the next 3 years. That's a lot of stores to be opening. Some of which, about 15 to 20 of which, are going to be pop-up like. The rest are going to be conventional. The idea here is, if you look at management strategy as to why they are looking to brick and mortar to grow their current business with Casper, they're trying to identify customers that aren't already in the market for a mattress. A lot of those customers are already familiar with their e-commerce business, but the idea here is very similar to the businesses that you see and that we'll talk about with Mattress Firm. The conventional mattress businesses offer a lot of trial settings. So you can go in, see the different selection of mattresses, and pick one. Whether or not you're in the market for one is sort of irrelevant, because once you're in the door, you may choose then to go open your wallet and buy a new mattress. So it's not only trying to take advantage of the customers that are currently in the market for a mattress, but those people that are maybe on the fence about it. They're weary about the price point of a particular mattress set. So In order to boost sales, CEO Philip Krim is eyeing a large brick-and-mortar presence in North America to drive in customers, like I said, who may not already be seeking out a mattress. And this is, again, a similar idea to other companies. However, management feels as though their current experience with pop-up shops combined with the current retail landscape with the conventional mattress stores has paved the way for them to make a bigger, more meaningful impression on their customer. One thing that analysts and academics alike have noted is the relative price point. Again, a lot of people are wary about buying a new mattress because they're not really quite sure how much it's going to cost them. Casper's ability to sell has come from a unique marketing strategy. By the way, a ton of podcasts they promote on, but being able to convey a message of affordability and quality at the same time, with many king mattresses being promoted around the $1,000 price point. So not bad if you were to try it at home for free. And this unique sales approach, compounded with the idea that customers can try it out for free and return it if needed, is bringing in a lot of money, roughly $100 million in revenue for their first year. And while sales are still strong for Casper, obviously the momentum has waned in the recent years as total sales this last January. So from 2014 to this last January, we're in the $600 million range. Compare that to their first year bringing in an astounding $100 million. Many feel like this is an opening for them to continue to differentiate, as there are certainly more online mattress sellers now than in 2014 when they were founded.
Amazon, for one, saw its mattress sales increase by 82% in 2017, and part of that is because you can get other direct-to-consumer mattresses using the Amazon platform. Casper, though, they have a strong brand. It's completely reasonable to think that more permanent physical stores could boost sales in all future channels. The one thing for us to stress is to focus on store footprint, which I'll talk about here in a second, not to overpay on leases. Mattress Firm is finding out this the hard way through very large and cannibalized locations. However, according to sources, Casper mainly just targeting top-tier malls to showcase their selection. Now let's talk about this Mattress Firm news. It was reported earlier this week that Mattress Firm may be considering a bankruptcy filing as a mechanism to get out of some pricier leases and shutter underperforming locations. For those locations that have had leases expire in 2018, Mattress Firm has already closed 200 of them. Many questions have arisen over the years about Mattress Firm's viability, including jokes circulating in the retail community. I've had a few texted to me about the stores being a front for organized crime, given the extraordinarily low traffic numbers that Mattress Firm has and seemingly poor sales. It's often a joke that you never see anyone even parked at a Mattress Firm during business hours. It seems like forever ago, but back in 2016, Mattress Firm was taken private for $3.8 billion by Steinhoff International. Former shareholders have to be enjoying the fact they got paid to get out when they did. Hard to believe that someone would have voted against that deal now as we look back and see the shape that Mattress Firm is in. News outlets, Reuters in particular, pointed to this as being another example of a brick-and-mortar retailer struggling in the face of online competition. But realistically, as is so often the case, there's a confluence of factors that have led to Mattress Firm's decline here. And honestly, this is the case in multiple different circumstances. Sometimes it's just easier to blame one particular culprit than to sift through the true reasons for a store chain's decline. The first and perhaps most important is the increased willingness of consumers to purchase mattresses here without first trying them in person. This has been helped by the robust return policies by the likes of Casper, Tuft & Needle, Purple, and others. I recently bought a Tuft & Needle mattress myself. Their return policy was easy to navigate, and what's more is they didn't actually take the return back. Instead, they organized for the mattress, if you didn't like it, to be donated to a local charity. So that's even better than a typical return policy. But the fact that you don't have to rebox up a mattress and send it out or get it ready for someone to pick up and ship away, that is a huge factor in deciding to buy a mattress online versus trying it out in person. And a lot of people go by Google and Amazon reviews now. We've talked about it on the show before, but if you've got thousands or even millions of Google and Amazon reviews on your product, people are more likely to trust those than need to go to that store and try out that mattress for their own body. Another factor in mattress firms' decline is real estate. As we alluded to at the end of the Casper story, mattress firm often has freestanding space on a busy intersection, usually almost always near an actual intersection, near a Class A or B retail center. Now, this space isn't cheap to rent, that intersection space in particular. One of the reasons they do this is for easy navigation, easy in and out. But you add this to the fact that their stores already have a relatively large square footage, around 4,000 to 10,000 square feet per store, according to Net Lease Advisor. Also, the fact that most of their leases are just double net, leaving the landlord to pay for roof and structure. Now, that seems like a good idea, but the reality is with a double net lease, if the landlord's taking care of the roof and structure, many times those will go for a slightly higher rate per square foot than a triple net lease. So the reality is you've got this massive store that you're paying a premium for. And the fact is, you need that store to be large because they're in a position as a store that carries many brands, and this leaves them somewhat vulnerable. And this is antithetical a little bit to the idea of the all-in-one store that's key in other areas of retail, particularly giants like Walmart, for example, have grown based on this concept. But showcasing mattresses from 9 different brands that they carry takes substantial room. Each one of these brands has different mattress lines, and this forces them to have larger square footages so that people don't have to hurdle mattresses to move to try one mattress over another. And this room is necessitated even after losing Tempur Sealy as a supplier last year. Of course, they not only have Sealy mattresses, but Tempur-Pedic mattresses as well. When you carry this many brands, not only do you need the square footage, but also inventory on these brands is more likely to collect in the back, leading to clearances and closeouts. In fact, in talking to a former Simmons executive years ago, mattress manufacturers are extremely loath to issue credit to retailers for returns. So it's difficult if you're a retailer to send that backstock mattress back to the manufacturer for some kind of future credit. And in fact, that's why some mattresses aren't carried at certain retailers, is because they couldn't come to terms on those credit deals. In the case of Casper or Purple or even Tuft & Needle, they have at most 3 types of mattresses, 2 types of pillows to display. So you're looking at those Casper retail stores, you're looking at, like I said, 3 different types of mattresses, 2 different types of pillows, maybe a few bed sets and that type of thing. That's pretty much it. Whereas your mattress firm, you're looking at maybe as many as 100 different models that you're trying to display, all kinds of pillows, all kinds of showroom pieces that force you to have higher square footage. And so Casper or Purple or Tuft & Needle or whoever it is that's selling those direct-to-consumer online mattresses, they can go with lower square footage in urban areas.
Well, as for the potential bankruptcy, Mattress Firm is working with Alex Partners LLP, a consulting firm that has guided businesses towards bankruptcy in the past. This is a consulting firm that has a lot of different offices throughout the United States, helps a lot of consumer-facing product companies and retail companies alike. Piper Jeffrey, in an analyst research note, mentioned that a bankruptcy would allow Mattress Firm to extract themselves from several leases. This is crucial for the company to right-size, and it may not be doable outside of filing a bankruptcy. According to Net Lease Advisor, their current leases often have 12-year terms with 10% increases every 5 years. As we've discussed on this podcast in the past, retail leases are often very airtight, and because Mattress Firm inhabits freestanding locations, landlords might not be as willing to cut a deal as they would for a strip mall or indoor mall-based store. So I think there's going to be a lot of issues here going forward for Mattress Firm if they decide to go this route. My big question is, what are exactly the underlying financials? Now that they've been taken private, we can't really see how they've been performing. What we saw before was a fairly strong balance sheet, although there was a lot of longstanding debt with the company that was taken over with that $3.8 billion price tag. But going forward, this is going to disappoint a lot of investors. I myself, Trent, I know you've seen it. A lot of freestanding buildings with mattress firms in place selling at 5, 6% cap rates because they feel as though this is a national credit tenant that's going to stay in there for a long time. And as is typical, the landlord is going to be able to get the benefit of all of those rent increases. Well, we move on to specialty retailer The Vitamin Shop, who sells supplements and nutritional products, as their name would indicate. They posted earnings and beat estimates by over 700 times, which resulted in an over 32% increase in their stock price on Wednesday. I believe this is only the second time, just the second time we've talked about The Vitamin Shop on this podcast. And this is the second entire story that really has some relevance for a number of reasons. Despite only having a $260 million market cap, The Vitamin Shop is looked at as a staple in the supplement industry and is a retailer that has started to evolve very fast in the last couple of quarters, given the level of competition seen online. GNC would be considered their biggest competitor, but several online marketplaces have done very well in terms of sales. Bodybuilding.com is one, Amazon is yet another. GNC now having their own store inside of Amazon that is said to do quite well from GNC's latest investor relations remarks. Vitamin Shop currently has 775 company-operated retail stores under the Vitamin Shop and Super Supplement retail banner, so they do have a wide presence in the United States.
Margins have eroded in some subsegments of the industry, given that heightened level of transparency and also a little bit of price warring going on, spurred on in part by the presence of Amazon, but also big box stores such as Costco and Sam's Club, who carry a larger variety of supplements and more brands than they did about a decade ago. For these second quarter results, it's important to note that these are officially just their preliminary results for the 3 months period ending June 30th. There were some items that were not finalized, but that said, this is an astounding quarter. Much like Office Depot, whom we led off the show with, these earnings beat in a massive way. Analysts were largely expecting earnings per share to be in the negative territory, ended up reaching 30 cents positive per share. Thomson Reuters, for the record, did put out a consensus estimate of 5 cents per share, but many analysts were on the lower end of that. And if you look solely at revenue, you'd be scratching your head to figure out why the stock reacted so well, even with the big earnings beat. Unlike with that legacy retailer in Office Depot, the top line figure for Vitamin Shop decelerated by 1%, mostly due to brick and mortar stores lagging. The final number came in at $293 million, about $3 million less than 2017. That's due almost entirely to same store sales being down 1.1%. But this is a pure example of a negative turn positive in that most people didn't expect their physical stores to put up great numbers. What many also didn't expect and provided the positive spin here was to see online or digital sales to increase by as much as they did. E-commerce sales popped a whopping 37%, which I don't think anyone saw coming for The Vitamin Shop. E-commerce sales for them have been doing better, but not better to this extent. Top-line revenue falling was just sort of a byproduct of new strategy and a transitionary period as these digital sales begin to pick up the slack where those sales in stores are falling off. Now, with a more omni-channel approach, the company has been funneling a lot of capital to smarter marketing tools, and it has paid off. Also, the company has cited favorable margins in the second quarter, which I think you could figure out. Top line revenue goes down, profits go up, margins must have increased. And that's ultimately what surprised us at the end of the day, because like we said, the increased velocity of competition here is real and it's going to stay the course for the foreseeable future. So to see the profits pop by that much, really a promising quarter for Vitamin Shop.
My sentiment is that Vitamin Shop is amongst a lot of strong competition right now, but they are faring very well and they are experienced in this industry. And if you think about the brand externality, the brand equity that they've built up over the years, just like with GNC, they still have it going on for them because a lot of the margin issues, those will subside in the long run. They exercise more discretion too, as far as their costs are concerned, with how they deployed marketing capital, which has been a theme as of late for retailers like this and others in niche specialty retail areas. New customer growth was 14% in the quarter, really speaking to how they deployed that marketing capital. But with revenues down 1%, retaining current customers is perhaps, in our opinion at least, the most important and easier way to get revenues staying up. Cheaper to retain customers than to capture a new customer who might just be temporary anyway. In-store promotions with a sort of grassroots approach to get people interested in their products. The Vitamin Shop does have a rather strong presence on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, by the way. I just looked before writing out all the notes for the story. They have a massive Instagram following with over 200,000 followers, which is essential for the health and fitness crowds out there. A lot of business is done on there from YouTubers and other celebrities that are taking to Instagram to showcase their fitness goals. The e-commerce sales boost was aided by an improved landing page, better category placement, and product showcasing in general. So you see a lot of happenings there. And this is something they needed because if you look at their webpage just 2 to 3 years ago, you can see that they needed a major transformation. And it looked as though they saw that and they pulled the trigger with some major improvements. They said time and time again that their key differentiator would be customer service. For Vitamin Shop, this is going to mean a seamless delivery system, less friction with their website, which is obviously something they're looking to right the ship on, and more transparent promotion and a robust buy online, pick up in store program. They're actually bullish on a relaunch that they are looking to take place later in 2018 for a buy online, pick up in store program. However, no rigid timeline there. Reportedly, management has been working closely with vendors to introduce new and unique products into stores. Over 100 new products in the second quarter alone. And they'll actually be looking to bring in more new products in Q3. Supposedly, if you look at the earnings transcript, more products in Q3, more new products than in the first quarter and second quarter combined. Some of the examples of new products include new protein powders, on-the-go items, and hemp-based products. Many companies have been attaching themselves to CBD products as well. I'm curious to see if they do anything as far as product assortment there. Margin expansion makes a bit more sense for the second quarter when you look at how they are putting more resources and energy behind private label products. Better pricing and marketing support will be keys for success as they grow and differentiate these private label assortments. 100 new brands and counting sounds like a lot for the second quarter, but at the end of the second quarter, they do a yearly tally and a quarterly tally. They had 700 total brands in their portfolio. So they have a lot of brands on board, private label brands included. Extending private label assortment could mean a much more efficient supply line if they cut off at least the least performing vendors in their current lineup. We must note that they did have an inventory charge this quarter, a one-time charge that hit the adjusted marks, and it was around $3.6 million, and it was related to adjusting their product assortment. So while this was noted in the one-time charge, the specifics weren't necessarily given. So I'm curious as to what that exactly had to deal with. They are piloting a new rewards program with different levels: gold, silver, bronze. This is going to be tweaked and looked at a little more closely in the fourth quarter and with some possible staying power here if everything works out. We think that a rewards program that goes beyond just a birthday gift and constant marketing emails is perfect for their type of retail niche.
And although GNC has kind of struggled to gain too much traction with their particular rewards program across the way, shares ended up for the Vitamin Shop 32.1% on Wednesday by trading's close, up to $10.70 per share, up nearly 67% for the year. Now, big picture, prior to July of 2017, the stock hadn't been below $10 per share since its latest IPO in 2009. In fact, it was more common to see the company's shares valued more between $30 and $50 between 2009 and 2016. So big picture, still fairly down from where they were at the heights of the company, but again, better than what they were just a year ago.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus podcast, a segment we call Looking Ahead, where each Leighton and I look at a retail story we're keeping an eye on for the next month or year or week or any period of time in the future, and we begin with Leighton.
Mine has to do with Party City, which we reported on for their latest earnings call, and they're going to be partnering with Amazon for this Halloween season. They're going to be having costumes and their own different marketplace on Amazon.com. It's going to be interesting because they do have over 900 stores in North America and a pretty functional website, a website that's actually been working a little bit better as of late. They've been funneling money into vendor programs. They've been funneling money into R&D because they're going to be vertically integrated with a number of their products. But this is interesting because they're sort of throwing their hands up and saying that, you know what, as far as network externality is concerned, the number of U.S. households that have a Prime membership is way more than visit our website. So I think it's going to be a win-win for both companies because Party City, to their credit, they do have a brand name. They have name recognition and they have a lot of assortment that people are enjoying. And I think Halloween is often a time where they're able to see a boost in top line revenue. And I think this is going to be interesting too, in that it's going to be profitable for them as long as their gross margins are intact. So it's, like I said, going to be a win-win for both companies, but it is interesting, and this is why it's a looking ahead for me, to see how many well-established companies, companies that are profitable, both private and public, have been partnering with Amazon as of late to be sort of a third-party retailer, showcasing their most affordable products or their most popular products on that platform to get both name recognition and a boost in revenue.
So my looking ahead story is very similar to the same looking ahead story I had a few weeks ago when Walmart said that they were expanding their baby, particularly their nursery selection. Well, this week, JCPenney issued a press release that said that they are targeting 500 JCPenney locations that happen to be near a specialty baby retailer. They didn't name who, but Babies R Us, that recently closed their doors. And they're going to take those 500 locations and expand the baby category in those particular locations. In fact, they want to expand it, almost make it a store-in-store concept. Now, I don't often tell retailers things on this show. As we've covered time and again, we tend to be wrong as often as we are correct. But I just want to say to retailers, just stop when it comes to the baby thing. Look, I get that baby numbers in terms of expenditures are supposed to increase. I get that Babies R Us and Toys R Us just closed. I've been behind most of JCPenney's efforts, whether it be the Sephora effort or the appliance effort or even the effort to build out toys this last holiday season. I think all three were fairly good ideas, but this is taking square footage that they have and funneling it towards something that is highly volatile in baby goods and baby supplies. And what's more than that, it actually takes a lot of time in terms of staffing, because baby clothes in a clothing retailer or in any retailer, the baby clothes and the baby aisles tend to be a little bit more mussed up than some of the other aisles, with the exception of maybe the toy aisle. So you're putting staff towards it, you're putting square footage towards it, all for something that we should remember wasn't really working that well for Babies R Us. They weren't able to climb their way out of debt. It's not as though they had this robust business that suddenly shut down. One of the things that JCPenney mentioned was developing a relationship with Carter's. And you would think, in this robust climate where we're seeing a lot of retailers post these great same-store sales, that would be the same case for Carter's. But Carter's, their brick-and-mortar same-store sales were actually down in their most recent quarter. Their overall comparable sales increased due to a growth of e-commerce sales, and that's pretty much it. So it's not as though things are fast-moving in the baby sector. And look, I know it's supposed to be huge. They mentioned in the press release JCPenney did $13 billion by 2021, but I think there are probably other areas to expand to, rather than just this transparent grab for market share that literally every other retailer worth its salt is doing to try and take over business from Babies R Us. People just aren't having kids at the same rate that they used to. That's expected to continue. So you're looking at fewer and fewer births every year. And yet it seems like we've almost had more businesses try to take over that Babies R Us market share. Something has to give and someone's got to lose in this battle. That's what I'm looking forward to, is how many retailers in 2 to 3 years blame this increase or this increased onus on baby goods for some top or bottom line failures. Well, that'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus Podcast. For Layton, I'm Trent, saying so long until next week. Got a couple of interviews lined up for next week. Also want to give a big thanks to MyEmma.com, the presenter of the Retail Focus Podcast this week. Until next week, so long.
been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.